This podcast is sponsored by Medallia, solutions for optimizing patient, member, and government healthcare experiences to achieve superior outcomes. Visit medallia.com to learn more.
You know, surveys have showed that Gen Z is like four times as likely to identify as trans or gender nonconforming compared to other, you know, generations, you know, and even within millennial generations, like upwards of, some surveys suggest, 11 to 12%.
Hi, welcome to HIMSCast. I'm Kat Jersich, Senior Editor at Healthcare IT News. The rise in telehealth utilization, especially amidst the COVID-19 pandemic, has highlighted the potential of virtual care to expand access to services. And these can be particularly important for people who might have difficulties for whatever reason in brick and mortar care settings. So here with me today to discuss how telehealth can help trans and gender nonconforming people access affirming care is Dr. Jerrica Kirkley, Chief Medical Officer and co-founder at Plume. Jerrica, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Kat.
I'm wondering if we could just get started by talking a little bit about Plume and how it works for listeners who might not be familiar with it.
Yeah, for sure. So Plume is a virtual gender-affirming care healthcare service. So we provide things like gender-affirming hormone therapy, some essential primary care services which supplement that, behavior health services, and do that through a mobile-first virtual format. So that's kind of the core of what we do. You know, our vision is to transform healthcare for every trans life. And we see that happening in a number of ways. I think there is the direct service component, as I mentioned, just providing those services to patients who engage with us, but also looking at it very broadly. You know, I think what a lot of folks in the gender affirming care community have been desiring for a long time is more perhaps clear guidelines or just even data and research studies to support the care that we provide, because historically it has not been collected very well, and it's improving. But I think as we have more and more folks who are receiving gender-affirming care services, especially in a consolidated care environment, it becomes easier to really see what are those clinical trends, population level trends. And so to really help inform the care process, not only within Plume and for our patients, but across the board, you know, in terms of the medical community at large, and understanding that it's a very dynamic and multifactorial process, right? There is core clinical care, there's understanding population-based health needs, but also, you know, thinking about social determinants of health and how do what we do engage with what other community partners are doing, and all the way up to the policy and advocacy level of like acknowledging that, you know, obviously it can be a very real threat to some in terms of how legislation is being enacted in terms of access to care and the types of care that we can access. So it's a, you know, there's a lot there, but I think that's kind of our vision, is to find out how we can be a partner and help enact change in all those different arenas.
That's all really fascinating. And I definitely want to dig into some of that. Maybe we can start with the data aspect. At Healthcare IT News, we do report a lot about data and how it can be used to support more effective care and also support policy, as you mentioned. So are there any kind of data insights that you could go into a little bit that have stemmed from Plume's care model?
Yeah, you know, we're kind of in the process of digging through a lot of that now and looking. And I think one, you know, one of those elements of kind of thinking how we impact the care environment and the gender affirming care scene at large is thinking about publication, right? So again, if we have a lack of publication, we want to find a way to contribute to that. So yeah, looking through a lot of that data now to actually make some formal publications, but which is exciting. And I think, you know, what we're looking at is, you know, the demographics that come up. And so, you know, what does the age range look like for folks accessing care? What does the geographic environment look like? Are they coming from urban, rural settings? And I think what we're, you know, one thing we're finding is people are coming from all different geographic settings. And I think there can be maybe an assumption that, okay, well, if you live in a rural area, you have limited access to care in general, more likely to, you know, to use like a telehealth service. But you know, in actuality, like it happens across the board. And I think what we're seeing is a lot of centers, especially in urban, large metropolitan areas, get overwhelmed and have long wait lists. And so you can still have, you know, access issues in those places that might have a higher density of providers who are you know, providing kind of gender affirming care services, you know, and I think it is an increasingly more visibility and kind of conversations around gender and the massive spectrum of gender in younger people, right? You know, I think we see that on a broader population level, you know, looking at trends where, you know, surveys have shown that Gen Z is like four times as likely to identify as trans or gender nonconforming compared to other, you know, generations, you know, and even within millennial generations, like upwards of some surveys suggest 11 to 12% identify as not cisgender, right? And so, you know, that is just in a big way becoming much more relevant in terms of, yeah, visibility and talking about gender. And so I think we see that reflected in our data where we do have, you know, a large portion of folks who are in that like 18 to 25 you know, range, but also, you know, it does extend across the spectrum. You know, we take care of course, folks up to, you know, in their 60s and there's, you know, starting this process, you know, can happen at any point in the lifespan. And of course there's many services that folks could be eligible for outside of just hormone therapy, for example, but yeah, so those are some trends that we're noticing.
That's so interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing more data about that because you're right. Because of fragmented care options, because of lack of visibility historically, there's really just not a lot of good cohesive research about a lot of LGBTQ health, including trans and gender nonconforming people.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one other fascinating thing that we're also seeing is, you know, we provide care currently on a cash only level. And so it was really intentional from the beginning because, you know, one thing that I observed as a provider of this, as a patient receiving care, is having insurance coverage doesn't necessarily equate to care, right? Like even, you know, if you are lucky enough to have your insurance cover the needed services, you still have to find a provider to provide those services in an environment that obviously feels safe, you know, welcoming, affirming, and with an actual clinician who has the clinical competence, and aligning all those together is so challenging. So, you know, we're noticing a lot of folks, you know, upwards of half who have insurance, but they're just not able to utilize it in other care settings. And I think the, you know, the bigger arc of that is like ultimately being able to accept multiple forms of payment, but even in that setting, like that actually becomes advantageous to, you know, sometimes not use your insurance, as unfortunate as that sounds, for various reasons, whether the access isn't there or complexity around, you know, how using insurance could interplay with personal social situations, work situations, family situations. And so there's a lot of variables to consider that can be unique to the trans and gender nonconforming experience.
That's really interesting too. I do want to return to the question of sort of financing care, but maybe before we get too deep into discussion, for listeners who might be thinking, I don't know what they're talking about right now, what does gender-affirming care look like in its most basic terms? You've mentioned hormones, yeah. You mentioned sort of attendant primary services. Uh-huh. What kinds of services are you offering to patients?
Yeah, great question. So I'd say gender-affirming care in its maybe purest sense is just any, and when we're speaking in terms of healthcare, so we'll say any healthcare service that is provided through an affirming lens that acknowledges the lived experience of the patient, right? So I think, of course, you can take that definition and apply it to many communities, but in this case, we say gender affirming because we're talking about, you know, trans, gender nonconforming individuals. So that could be hormone therapy, which is a much needed service. You know, upwards of 80% of trans folks identify that as a need. Of course, not all trans people seek out hormone therapy, but the majority do. There could be things like coordinating and providing surgical services, which are like gender affirmation surgeries. And then, so those are very specific to the gender experience. But again, there's many things like just basic primary care, preventative health, anything you might need as a human being provided in that affirming way, you know, in a safer environment. But again, there are some more specific things that kind of might fall into the, maybe a bit more of a specified field of kind of like gender affirming care, really when it comes to, you know, and so from a medical perspective, hormones and surgery obviously get talked about the most, but there's a lot of things that, you know, need, you know, where there are needs, but the healthcare system hasn't traditionally done. And that's something that we're also trying to creatively think about. For example, like there's a lot of legal and social issues the trans folks have to navigate. It might be, you know, if you desire to change your gender marker or your name, and there could be many ways, and as we know, in our systems of identification where that might take place, you know, everything from social security to birth certificate, driver's license, health insurance, bank, you know, and just doing that can be incredibly daunting and complex and challenging. So it's like, how can you provide help with some of those pathways, which aren't traditional, you know, medical care, but like being able to provide some guidance and again, do it in an affirming way, I think could also easily fall into that category of, you know, gender affirming care. Yeah.
Definitely. I'm thinking about, for example, I've read stories about trans women who are not offered care that would be more appropriate for them because of various biases inherent in the medical system, or trans men or non-binary people, beyond the sort of run-of-the-mill conversations with medical providers that might feel unsafe in the moment for whatever reason. I think there are also medical challenges that do arise. We've been thinking about this at Healthcare IT News from an EHR perspective, because often we see that there's not really a standard in electronic health records to outline assigned sex at birth, gender, identity, sexuality, things like that. And so there's not good information on patients, and then they can't receive the most comprehensive care possible. So I think there's a lot of, there's a lot of exciting things coming down the pike. And I wanted to talk a little bit about policy too. Are there, I noticed that Plume only operates in some parts of the country. Are there policies from like a telehealth perspective that you're excited about in terms of enabling greater access to care throughout the country?
Yeah, I think there are some promising things coming. And, you know, from an expansion, we're in 33 states right now. A part of just being able to expand is a function of licensing, you know. And so, you know, we obviously have to, our providers have to be licensed in the state that they're providing services in. And so that can just take time to get that provider network, and to, you know, applying for licenses takes time just for them to come through. You know, and our intention is to be in every state. And so we're on that pathway. Now, policy changes that could certainly help with that. And I think, you know, we're not quite there yet, but a bit more momentum of getting there, hopefully in the future, would be things like universal licensing, you know, like, and our licensing system is incredibly fractured and complex. Like every state has its own medical board, which, you know, doles out licenses based on their kind of medical board requirements. But in the end of the day, like everybody's effectively saying the same thing. Like we're all practicing medicine. Like, you know, if you treat a rash in Iowa, it doesn't change how you treat a rash in Florida. Like you should be following the same standards of care, right? And same thing goes with gender affirming care in any other field. And so it is a little bit archaic to have this incredibly fractured system. So if they're, and I think what's exciting is now, even though, you know, we, like my co-founder and I, and I think a lot of other people in healthcare have acknowledged the value of telehealth, and that it not as a backup option, but actually as a first choice can be very helpful. And in fact, a better modality of care than in-person care for different care pathways and populations. Now that everybody is picking up on that, say like, oh, actually, like, okay, we had to go to telehealth because we couldn't go to our office. And it turns out I like that a lot better. And it works better for me. You know, now that that momentum is there, I think we, that could help push along things to say like, yeah, why are we delaying this licensing process, you know, at the cost of people getting the care they need, when it's like, oh, if we can do telehealth, we can practice anywhere. And we should hold ourselves, of course, to the same standards that we would apply to everybody. So I think universal licensing could be very helpful along the lines of medical licensing for physicians, you know, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, all of our providers who are providing that direct care. And, but I think can go the same for behavioral health providers as well. They're bound by licensing requirements. And then some more specific things when it comes to, for example, like controlled substance prescribing, and that's separately licensed. So very, very fractured. I'd love to see some streamlining there. And then I think like just a general adoption of telehealth, I think that can also help influence policy in terms of access to broadband, for example, you know, which is of course a requisite if you're going to be accessing medicine this way or healthcare this way. So that's something that's a bit more adjacent, but super important. And I think can also be helped pushed along. And then there are some, just some like nuanced care considerations within, like, for example, like, you know, controlled substance prescribing and how that gets regulated, and understanding the importance of that in the realm of gender affirming care. So yeah, a lot of areas that I think are getting the attention that they need, they haven't had in a while. And we could start to see some change. This is exciting.
Yeah, definitely. I did want to go back to the question of financing, and you just mentioned broadband as a way to ensure connectivity and access. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what sorts of financing assistance programs are in place at Plume to ensure that people do have access to care who might not have the cash that they need for a subscription.
Yeah. Well, one thing that we have set up is what we call our HRT Access Fund. And this was started with an organization called Point of Pride. And so Point of Pride is a trans-founded nonprofit who's had a surgery access fund for a while now. And so, yeah, similar, like an application basis, folks that have financial need can apply and actually have, you know, gender-affirming surgeries paid for. So we started a similar fund, but for hormone access, knowing that that was, you know, obviously a huge gap as well. And so that's kind of our main mechanism outside of paying for direct services to help supplement that. And so we provide free care for an entire year, including any medical services or medications needed. And so we're always looking to help fundraise for that. You know, we have like a link on our website that links to Point of Pride and the donation site, and looking for different ways, of course, to fundraise. But that is a mechanism that we have right now.
That's great. I know we only have a few minutes left here. I did want to ask, what are you excited about in terms of the future of providing trans-affirming care and gender-affirming care in general? I know that from a state policy level, there are some, you know, sort of worrisome bills in various houses mm-hmm. about trans care, especially for minors and youth. And so mm-hmm. are there things that make you optimistic?
Yeah, there are. There absolutely are. I mean, it is, you do have to take a step back sometimes, because it can be daunting to see, like you said, you know, certain legislation coming through, just political climate. But I do, for a lot of the reasons mentioned, genuinely believe that things are shifting in a really momentous way, and in a way that I do not think they've moved in the past, you know. And for better or for worse, I do think COVID really pushed a lot of this to the forefront in a way that just wasn't acknowledged. So, I mean, I'm excited about, again, I do think there are some policy changes that will very clearly benefit access to care for trans folks in the face of, you know, some of this other stuff that's going on. I think, you know, I'm really excited about just how we're centering communities in care, you know, and I think that's really what we're trying to prove out, is that actually you can organize healthcare around a community and their needs, not solely around disease processes or medical conditions, you know, which is of course the historical precedent and where I think it's gone wrong a lot of ways, because we try to fit everybody into this one box and turns out we don't fit because we're all unique and special and different, you know? So I think, and we're seeing more and more, I think newer healthcare organizations and some older ones start to recognize the value there. And I think that's really where you talk about, you know, shifting the paradigm. And I think like a lot of exciting movement at just across the board in the healthcare industry when it comes to, like, we're talking about financial access and how health insurance payers are thinking actually about this differently, you know, and really recognizing that health equity and again, how we're centering care around communities and acknowledging all the aspects of their lived experience, not just what's going on in pen and paper in a clinical office, is going to, I think, will dramatically shape how folks can access care. So I am excited about a lot. I mean, there's always, you know, always the stuff, you know, lurking there that we need to be conscious of and keep in mind, but I am optimistic. There's a lot of things changing.
That's great. Well, thank you so much again, Jerrica. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, no, you're very welcome, Kat. Thanks for having me.
And to all our listeners, thanks so much for tuning in. If you liked this episode, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, and stay safe out there. Thanks. This podcast is sponsored by Medallia, solutions for optimizing patient, member, and government healthcare experiences to achieve superior outcomes. Visit medallia.com to learn more.